close to a century, coal mining was the driver here in the rural community of Dunlap, Tennessee. But by the early 1990s, the coal industry was history. The old coke ovens built back in 1902 remain as decaying relics of a time when more than 400 locals were employed in the mine. The old coke ovens built back in 1902 remain as decaying relics of a time when more than 400 locals were employed in the mines. In homage to Dunlap's past, the annual Coke Ovens Bluegrass Festival was created to honor the town's heritage and serves as a primary source of funding for the Sasquatchie Valley Historical Society. The little town of Dunlap also decided collectively to clean up the town's abandoned dead dog garbage dump back in the 1980s. Today, the sprawling, grass-covered, tree-shrouded Coke Ovens Park is a showcase of transformation and restoration of a once blighted area, and it's the home of the annual Coke Ovens Bluegrass Festival. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. I was in the company of fellow journalist Joy Lucius from Tupelo, Mississippi, where she's also associate to the pastor at the Tupelo Word of Life Church.
Edward Brown, hi.
We're in Dunlap, Tennessee, and we're at the Coke Ovens Historical Park. We're on the Register of Historical Sites, and this is an 88-acre park right now. It's not funded by any governmental organization or civic organization. We're here today during a bluegrass festival that is our fundraiser for the year, and that kind of keeps our doors open. And it's managed by the Sequatchie Valley Historical Association. Is who takes care of it. We maintain it strictly by volunteers all that sort of thing. We've got some music going on under the pavilion over there. We anticipate possibly a little rain.
The roots of this area, this was coal mining?
Probably the main economical factor in this area prior to coal was lumber and, of course, agriculture. That sort of thing. Railroad was put up through here, and I think about 1888, something like that. It run up all the way up to the head of the valley, up to Pikeville, Tennessee. Coal was a economical factor here from the late 1800s on up till probably the 1980s, when most of the underground mining here in this Cumberland Plateau was stopped. There has been surface mining out here, and the surface mining lasted longer, but it finally played out too. Most of it was done out on the Cumberland Plateau here.
And there were coke ovens here, so they processed the coal right here.
Yes. This site that we're on was a company had came in here and built coke ovens beginning in 1899. An Englishman actually came and helped them lay it out. He was one of the experts on it, and they built eventually 268 beehive coke ovens. Now, the company started in 1809, I believe I said that, but they went bankrupt in 1927. The operation shut down. But at one time now, they worked about 350 people here, so it would have been a tremendous economic factor here in the early part of the 1900s there in this little small town of Dunlap.
When did the coke operations and coal mining stop here?
Probably in the early 1980s in the underground mining, especially out in a couple of counties a little south of us here, Marion County and Grundy County. The surface mining lasted a little longer. It was probably up into the 1990s or so.
So the people that live today in Dunlap, they're pretty much descendants and people that their parents or somebody was involved in coal?
Quite a few of them, but a lot of people don't know the history of this. We have folks come up here from here in Dunlap and the Sequatchie County and this area, this Sequatchie Valley area, and they'll ask, well, what is coke, you know? And a lot of them nowadays just don't, there's no mining here, so it doesn't mean anything. People come up here once in a while, and they'll want to know where they can get some coal at. Well, I heard that you can buy some down in Alabama, but, you know, 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, there was coal yards everywhere. People heated with coal and everything else, but It was an economic factor that gave a boost to the county in the early 1900s. There was workers brought in, all these rocks that you see in the coke ovens out there, especially on the retainer walls, they were cut by rock masons. And when you see them, they're laid pretty good, you know. Now the walls are deteriorating somewhat, so take that in consideration when you see them. But the inside of the coke oven had fire bricks. And after they'd been fired for a little bit, they'd glaze over and then they'd hold that heat so another charge could begin.
Dovetail back today in your bluegrass festival and the music tradition that's here.
Oh, the Sequatchie Valley Historical Association was formed in 1984, and I was in on that. I like history. And we acquired about 65 acres of this park from a company over in East Tennessee, a land company.
I understand this was a garbage dump for the area.
It was a garbage dump. It was called the Dead Dog Dump right here in town, and people used to come up here and do other activities around it. It was abandoned, and we used to come up here and target practice into the slate dump. So we got it. The National Guard helped us. We had donations. We took up somewhere between 125 and 150 tons of garbage out of this place. There's still glass, broken glass. Every time it rains, it'll come to the surface. But anyway, we had a gift from a gentleman from another county. He was deceased, and he left us about $71,000 as estate, and we got this building here in the black for that $71,000, and we opened it up in '89.
And this was a recreation of the commissary from the mining days.
Yes, it was. It was built back as near as possible as we could get it, like the old commissary, and they had some offices upstairs.
Back for a moment to the garbage dump transformation, because I understand that you all won a national award from the President of the United States.
We did. Our local historian, Carson Kemp, and his wife went to Washington and received that from President Reagan. Yes, when you would come up here then, all you'd see is garbage, you know, mattresses, everything in the world thrown away. And we're still cleaning on it somewhat, but we have it. It's in as good a shape right now, the ground is, as we've ever had it.
Well, I'd never know. Coming in here this morning, it was like going into a national park.
We've had a lot of good comments on the park itself. We have numerous trails for people to walk. There was also, in 1838, there was a portion of Cherokee Indians during the Trail of Tears ordeal that took place in this country. They spent one night here on this property, and that came from a journal of a preacher that went with them all the way. And this road goes up the mountain close to the park here that we call it now Fredonia Road. It was called Old Hill Road at that time. That's the road that they took. It was also that same road, I believe it was, where General Wheeler that done the raid down the valley here in 1863.
Near Chattanooga?
It was in Sequatchie Valley here.
Right here, wow.
Yeah, but it's about, 10 or 11 miles down the road from us here. But part of it was in this county, and the biggest portion of the wagon train was in Marion County. But General Wheeler found it, and he sent about 1,000 of his men down there to told them to burn it. They was trying to get food to the Union troops in Chattanooga, so they burnt that wagon train down. And people ask, well, why didn't he keep it? Well, he was a cavalry unit. He not going to sit there and guard anything. So he didn't want the Union getting it, see. So then he took off up Hill Road, and he was going through Middle Tennessee is where he was going.
Right now, this is an annual fundraiser bluegrass festival for you.
It is. It's our 30th year. We started out in 86, really, we had our first festival. Then in 87, we started having a competition with bands and individuals, and we've done that for years. And then we shifted to concerts. And right now, that we do the concerts, we've had about 9 bands plus a violin fiddle workshop. We call it a fiddle around here in the South, you know. We had a workshop here this morning for a couple of hours. It was really, really well received. and the concert's going on now, and it went on last night also. And this is what keeps our doors open. It pays the electric bill, the water bill, the phone bill, our insurance. We got insurance on this building and that, and then, but we don't have any paid employees or anything like that.
So you guys were a little scared this morning with the clouds and rain coming in.
That rain, somebody asked me yesterday, said, why did you move that over? I said, the weather dictates whether we do it over at the amphitheater over here in the pavilion. It did pour down rain here yesterday evening, but then it tapered off and we could have it. So I'm hoping we have pretty good luck today. The bluegrass songs that has been written is a lot of it. Somebody said if you had a path and a little cabin somewhere and a mom and dad, you could write a bluegrass song about it, you know. And in other words, they try to touch your heart with those songs like that. Some of it, quite a bit of it in the early days, came from the British Isles. We'd take some of their songs and we'd Americanize them a little bit, you know.
A little Irish and Scots in there, too.
And Scottish and the Knoxville. They used to have a lot of murder ballads and bluegrass. And actually, in my opinion, it stems from folk music. When Bill Monroe come on with a high singing tenor voice and playing a mandolin and doing real fast, and he got a banjo players to join him, three-fingered banjo pickers, then that came a little different, a little faster, a little different. But it's a lot of, it come out of folk music, really.
Do you play an instrument?
I play the banjo, mostly. That's what I do in the band that I'm in. I've been playing now for 62 years.
So you started when you were a little kid, then?
I was 15 years old when I started.
What's the name of the band that you play in?
The name of the band is the Cumberland Band.
And where are you all based?
We're based right here. There's three and four of us right here. One guy is from about 30 miles south, and the young lady sings with us is about 40 miles from here over in North Hamilton County.
One thing I noticed listening to the different bands today, it seems to bridge the generations. It's like every band has older people, middle-aged people, and then you seem to always see at least one or two younger people.
Like to get those in it.
And it does bridge generation gaps.
It does. It sure does. That's a good way of putting it. I like to see young folks doing well. I'm a piano technician and a music teacher, but I teach privately. I teach banjo and fiddle and guitar and mandolin and other odds and ends, dulcimers and basic piano, a few things like that.
In your church, do you have bluegrass music played in church today?
We do some. I was the music director at my church for 28 years, and I didn't do bluegrass a lot. I did every once in a while, and we'd have outings somewhere that the banjo and stuff would fit, you know, singing down on the river and a picnic and baptizing. But I used mostly the Baptist hymnals and some of the Stamps Baxter music, that shape note music, they call it, you know.
I can sing you some shape notes now. I came from Primitive Baptist. Yes, sir. So I can sing you Sweet Affliction. You know that one?
We're not. Do it.
Do me so, so, re, re, mi, re, do. So, fa, mi, mi, re, do, re, mi, do. In the floods up, you know, and it went like that. So, yeah. Well, that's awesome. Even though in church when you did just sing the hymnals, don't you think that they tended to have a bluegrass sound even when you...
You can take just about any of them, especially the Stamps Baxter, and you can stick a banjo and a mandolin and a fiddle in there, and it fits like a glove. What I call the traditional hymns,
yes,
which I don't get me wrong, I love the traditional hymns too. I think they are the good meat of the gospel. But some of those can have a tendency to be a little more classical in nature. But you can adapt them if you're kind of creative with it. But a lot of the shape note hymnals, you can pull most of them out of there and speed up the tempo just a little bit.
That's awesome. I really appreciate it. Can I have the honor of praying for you?
Sure you can.
All righty.
Yes, ma'am.
All righty.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
She's a special person.
Well, she is.
Sometimes.
For further information, how would somebody get in touch with you?
Well, they could email me, and it is Marlicid, M-A-R-L-I-S-E-D, at Bledsoe, bledsoe.net.
Excellent.
Email me and I'll be glad to do anything I could. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting from Knoxville, Tennessee. Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada. Kim Schneider from Michigan. Elaine Masters in San Diego. Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon. Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas. And Steve Cook, contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkan Songs on NPR affiliate KUAR.
Oh, God.